Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO, a loose discussion of travel, diving, driving, gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 192, and it's proudly brought to you by the ever-growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support, and those of you that are listening that might want to support the show and aren't already, please do visit thegreynato.com for more details. James, your bags are packed. You're ready to fly out here any minute here now, right?
Yeah, I'm still batting 1,000 on COVID tests. I apparently remain untouchable. My luck has to run out at some point, I assume. But so far we're good. But yeah, I'm actually. So there's the previous episode was kind of timed around a New York trip, and then I was home for, I don't know, what is it, 8 or 9 days or something, and now I'm back. I'm going back to New York this time just for some meetings. Sadly, it's a pretty full schedule. So if you're one of the folks that pings me when I get to the city to see if I might be around, I don't think I will be this time. But hopefully, now that the New York travel route is kind of open and easily understood, we should be able to make that up. And we're probably what do you think, Jason? We're probably at least in the zone to start thinking about a get together at some point.
Maybe, I think so.
Maybe after the summer or something like that. And we actually have a pretty exciting in-person event that we can announce soon, but I don't think we can announce yet. Keep in mind for that, and that'll be a little later this year, which will be super fun. But Jason, you know what? I do want to say just before we dig into the show, you had mentioned the supporter crew and such in our little opening, repetitive opening blurb. If you're on the fence about the $5 a month or the $100 a year, which gets you the strap and the stickers and the rest of it, the last episode of the Q&A is really, I think, something worth considering, testing the waters at $5 a month for. We had a really good time with it. One of the most fun episodes I think we've recorded in a while, eh, Jason?
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. It was a good crop of questions. And I think, I don't know, you and I just seemed kind of tuned up for that. It was a long episode too. I think we'll, and it's funny, we finished, I think we did, I don't know, maybe 14 questions or thereabouts. And I think we've got at least that many already queued up for the next one, which we'll record in a few weeks.
But yeah, if you want to know about some of the music that we connect with our watches or who we think would win in a bar fight or that kind of stuff, now might be a good time to jump in. We're going to start really leaning into those Q&A episodes, making them nice and long, taking every question, even the silly ones. We really enjoy those. So if you've been on the fence, not a bad time to consider one or the other of the two levels, especially with the five. You could, if you really didn't like it, you could just bounce back to the normal feed. Other than that, Jason, I mean, what's new? You're back. It's been what? You've been home for like 10, 11 days.
Yeah.
Are you about back on a normal sleep schedule? They say it's like something like an hour a day that you get back, right?
Well, that seems to be holding true. Yeah, you're right. I think it's been 11 days and I went to sleep at 10 o'clock last night, got up at about 5:15. So yeah, I think that's fairly normal for me, especially in the summer. It starts to get light. Right. Around that time. So I can live with that. I'm happy with that.
Right.
I don't mind getting up early. I just don't like, early being 1 a.m. So it's nice to be back to somewhat
I mean, five
normal.
Feels pretty early for me. but I have enjoyed those. So I've been trying, I don't know if I talked about this on the podcast or maybe you and I have just chatted about it, but the pandemic really, like, I became kind of lazy in terms of when I would get up in the morning.
Yeah.
It could be late. It could be 9:30, 10, like later than when I was a kid, later than when I was in my teens, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it's just because, like, why? Like, you're getting and all I need to do is roll over, make a cup of coffee, and put my laptop in my lap and start working.
Right.
So I've been trying to kind of let the sun teach me how to get closer back to, say, 7 o'clock. I'm not going to go crazy here. And I don't mind getting up at 6 if it's to go diving or whatever, but I don't really want to get up that early just because.
Yeah.
7:30 feels pretty comfortable these days, and that's kind of where I'm pushing. But the sun is making it easier. So to wake up in the morning and be already bright out,
yeah,
and kind of feel like, oh, it's going to be a nice sunny day today.
Yeah,
has been a real kind of like positive change over the last few weeks here. So that's good.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah.
And then speaking of general timing, we were just chatting before we started recording. It seems like you got out of Sri Lanka while it was still kind of a straightforward thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, for anyone out there who's been watching or listening to the news lately, I think now Sri Lanka is really popping up in the news because the prime minister has now resigned and he's fled to the naval base on the east coast and kind of bunkered himself in there, and full on riots in the streets. And it's a real shame to kind of watch and hear from family and friends over there that to see what's going on. You know, I don't want to kind of hype up only the bad side. I think, you know, I've talked enough about how great Sri Lanka is, how much I love the country. And, you know, it's just a shame that these peaceful protests that have been going on for a month, since pretty much the day we arrived over there in early April, have gotten really ugly. And I think it was inevitable. And I think, you know, change is needed there. And I don't know, I hope things improve. It's a very hour to hour situation these days. So we're watching that closely. But yeah, fortunately, Gashani and I got out just days before things hit the fan over there, and happy to be home, but also, you know, thinking about all of our friends and family over there.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's a scary time, and you've been sending me some updates. I've been catching a little bit of it on Instagram as well. So hopefully this is one of those things where something has to kind of, not to sound naive, and let's face it, I probably am naive on this topic, but where some things have to change very rapidly to allow a base for something good to come up.
Yeah.
So hopefully that's the case. Obviously, it seems like the whole world is dealing with its fair share of political problems, but that hits home, especially like both figuratively and literally with you having been there for so long. So
yeah, true.
We'll definitely keep that in mind. And if we see a good way of supporting the folks of Sri Lanka, let's try and find an outcome, kind of true to form with what we like to do.
Yeah.
Other than that, I mean, I don't have a ton to report. I was in New York and then have been back and trying to catch up with work, which I really haven't. I'm way behind.
Yeah.
And then supposed to leave for the airport in about 20 minutes.
We should probably dive into the topic.
Candle at both ends, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
How about we do a little bit of wrist check? Because you've got kind of a cool watch and a highlight of another cool watch.
Yeah. I've got on a pretty cool watch. It came from a friend over at Citizen. They sent it just before I went to Sri Lanka. I didn't pack it along, but I've been wearing it off and on since I got back. This is the Citizen EcoDrive ProMaster Diver 200 meter, and it's a watch with a titanium case, almost like a textured, almost looks like it's been powder coated, kind of a dark, very dark gray, almost black titanium case. And then it has this blue camo dial, and the case shape is that sort of square case with those sort of ears on the corners, and almost like, I don't know if you remember the Seiko had that watch called the Ashtray back in the early 80s, and this was kind of a competitor to that. I think from the early 80s, Citizen made a watch that was water resistant to about, I think it was 1300 meters or some strange depth rating. Okay. And this sort of pays homage to that. And it's cool. It's a cool watch. It's not, I wouldn't say it's exactly
I found it here.
Is there a reference number for this beast?
Yeah, it's the BNO228-06W. So I would recommend the show notes.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, this is a really cool looking thing. Is it huge?
It's
47.
It's huge in that it's square, but the lug to lug isn't huge because it's exactly square. And then it's really thin. I mean, it's only 200 meter water resistant, but for the kind of the width of it, it sits very flat. Like extremely flat on the wrist.
Got a big kind of Ploprof style bezel.
Yeah, yeah. And then that kind of knurled crown that Citizen's used over the years on their like the EcoZilla and AutoZilla stuff, and kind of funky hands, great loom. I'll admit I like some camo when it's done tastefully. This is kind of cool because it's blue. Kind of gives you that like, you know, spear fisherman sort of look to it. And
right.
Great, real flexy, soft rubber strap and a big chunky buckle. So, you know, it weighs nothing. So it's a fun watch, and being an eco drive, it's very grab and go. So
my wife always says that you're good, unless you're maybe in the military or whatever, obviously, yeah. But everyone's good with one piece of camo.
Like yeah.
Pants, stick to just pants. Don't do the shirt.
Yeah.
As
right.
Well, if it's a jacket, don't also do the, like, just be chill.
Yeah,
one piece.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I think a strap or a dial makes a lot of sense. And this is cool looking for sure.
It is very cool, and it's a watch that, like I said, it just isn't my taste, but I'm enjoying it. I'm actually, I went for a run this morning. I had it on, and it, you know, it doesn't weigh anything, so it was kind of good for that. And the bezel has this sort of weird, like light, almost plasticky feel. Almost doesn't make any noise when you turn it, but it's solid. It feels good. So, and then I wanted to mention that I've caught a glimpse of a couple of new Aqualands that Citizen has released, and this is part of that legendary first generation Aqualand looking watch. They kind of went from the CO23 reference name to the JP2000s that came in the 90s, and this one's the JP 2007-17W is the one that I've got my eye on, and that's it's the one with the full loom dial, and it's the old Aqualand case, so it's the one with the kind of the depth sensor that sticks out on the left side. I mean, it's classic looks, and then with that full loom dial, I mean, I love this thing. It's such
super
a cool
watch.
Yeah.
So it looks like the series is called the JP200, and and they've added two new models. So it's this loom dial, which, let's face it, that's probably the move.
Yeah.
Or there's this shiny kind of gradient sunburst sort of bluey dial one.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to see what the price point is on these because I'm also pretty keen.
Yeah.
Yeah, 430 euros. So probably what's that, $500-$600 US?
Yeah.
Maybe less, you know. It also, every time I'm on their website now to look at that previous one, the square titanium one that you've got.
Yeah.
And they've got 20% off. So
maybe
your deal is just to check their website specifically.
Right.
But yeah, I think it's super fun to see more of the specifically enthusiast stuff from Citizen. Like, these are not going to be big sellers. These aren't going to be watches that like hit their top 20 SKUs.
Right.
You know what I mean? But for folks who really love a dive watch, especially the 80s sort of dive watch, I want to say like the original was like mid 80s, 85, 86.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it has the other thing I really like about this is they're still doing it where the buttons, almost like with the G-Shock, the four buttons have labels, or the three buttons
labels. Yeah.
But here it's like it's printed on the case.
Yeah.
Rather than being like painted or something. It almost looks a bit like a little like a light engraving.
Yeah.
And it just has that like toolish sort of not quite tactical sort of vibe. These are cool. I would definitely get one of these in for review and do a little diving if I could and that sort of thing. So maybe something to consider over the summer.
Yeah, right. So what have you got on? I know what you have on. I was going to wear the same thing, but then I switched just to be different.
Yeah, I got excited because I saw yours. I was like, we'll talk. But Don from Verdix, who we've had on a past episode, check the show notes for that. We'd been going back and forth because I really wanted to check out the M60 Aqualion.
Yeah.
Which you've talked about a ton. We've talked about it a bunch on past episodes. We don't need like a ton of detail on this one, but I will be doing a hands-on with Hodinkee, so stay tuned for that. But I waited a little bit because they do a DLC version now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's full black, no date, with a bracelet. And honestly, like from opening the container the watch comes in, which is kind of the only word for it. It's not a box or really even a case. It's a container. Like it's this. It's sort of in the zone of a Pelican, which I think you talked about when we first talked about this watch.
Yeah.
And then it's all custom-cut foam, straps, tools, little container for spare spring bars because everything's quick change. So like bracelet comes on and off in 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
From the get-go to the wearing it on my wrist for a couple of days, I'm floored.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's an excellent watch. The loom is incredible. One of the best bezels I've ever come across.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I could compare it to would be something like an Ocean King from Manta, where it really feels like somebody went to the extra effort to not do anything off the shelf.
Right.
So it's still a micro brand, if you want to call it that. It's still like a $3,000 watch, right? A little bit more, actually, because I think it's like 3,000 pounds.
Yeah.
Give or take. And I think you could spend 20 minutes with this watch and understand why it costs what it costs. The bezel is flat out incredible. Like it's up there with a Pelagos. It's up there with the Ocean King. Like it's just feels really sure-footed. It's also like to do I've talked about this before, but to do a high quality 60 click bezel is pretty difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And this one is exactly what you want. The loom is wild. It's obviously great timekeeping with the COSC movement, you know, 600 meters water resistance. It's 40 millimeters. It's not too thick. It's not too big lug to lug. It's got two pin spring bar positions.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So you can kind of tailor it, whether it's for a NATO or to get this really close fit on the bracelet. It's just a lot of attention to detail, nicely made. It's not inexpensive. Like, you know, it's not like you're buying, you know, any of the many micro brands under $1,000, but it is one of these things where maybe you've had a run of all the watches that are under $5,000 and you want something a little bit more interesting, a little bit left field or more like directly attached to a person, in this case with Don and his team.
Yeah.
And I think you start to see the value here. I mean, Jason, you and I are a fan of micro brands in the first place. But this is my first time having a Verdix in person for more than about 5 minutes. I'd seen them on a press launch years ago, the early bronze one. But I think this is an excellent dive watch. Feels super high quality, nicely made, nice size, great on a NATO. I'm happy with it.
I think your analogy to Monta is a good one. I hadn't thought about that, but you know, these are brands that they, because they're smaller, they're less known, and they're selling into a space that's occupied by a lot of the bigger brands, you know, the Tudors of the world and the Bremonts almost.
Right.
They have to try harder, and they do try harder. I mean, you look at the packaging, you look at the number of straps and tools and just the attention to detail. And it's like, you realize that, you know, if big brands tried this hard, you know, you'd be floored, and to get it from a brand that's essentially run by one guy. And you're right. I mean, the bezel's fantastic. And I almost think there isn't a watch that has better lume, bar none, than these Vertexes. I wear mine to sleep in every now and then, especially with jet lag. And you know, I can wake up at 2:30 in the morning and look, and it's just glowing like a torch.
It's bright all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It uses that X1 Super Luminova, which can be milled.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So the actual the dial furniture is made of lume. That's the easiest way to describe it. It's not lume in a little setting.
Yeah.
Kind of like a jewel would go in a setting or in a ring.
Yeah.
It's actually like a big three-dimensional three that sits on the dial, and the whole thing glows, and the bezel glows strong enough to match it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm obviously a huge sucker for lume. So that's a little bit of a, you know, a proclivity of mine. I'll like a watch that has good lume, but if you're used to a fresh Seiko with big markers, a Monster, a good Seiko, an SKX, this is, I would say, the step above that in terms of brightness. Yeah. It's just very impressive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool piece. You know, congrats to Don on that. I'll collect all my thoughts together into a story, which will come out probably sometime in May. So stay tuned for that.
Nice.
What do you say? You want to get into the main topic?
Yeah. We're kind of revisiting something that we did, and I think you said episode 33 or something, like way
33,
back.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And it came up in that thread we opened when you were off for gallbladder issues. We asked people to suggest show ideas,
mm-hmm.
and one of them was, you know, when you guys did the perfect $10,000 watch trio, you both picked your Rolex, and neither of those could be bought on their own for 10 grand today.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the difference between episode 33 and episode 192. we wanted to update this for 2022. It's kind of a nice, straightforward, watch heavy topic. So again, this is 10 grand and just how would we spend it? If you could snap your fingers and your collection went away, and you had 10 grand in your pocket that you had to spend on watches, how would you do it? And the idea kind of being like one that doesn't really leave you looking for any more watches.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So Jason, why don't you, like, I've got several scenarios. I think you probably do too. So why don't you start painting us the picture of how this might work for
yeah.
you?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny you say that. It's kind of an appealing prospect that, like, if you just wipe the slate clean, where would you start? I don't know why that's appealing. I mean, I love all my watches, but it's almost impossible to do that because, you know, your tastes presumably are attached to watches that you have or something similar. And so I almost can't mm-hmm. get away from ones that I already own. And I think my choices here reflect that. I mean, I think most of them, if not, well, no, with a couple of exceptions, are watches that I do own. And
right.
you know what I decided? If I were to start all over again, I'm not going to pretend that I'm going to, you know, look for a chronograph or a dress watch. I mean, that's not me. I mean, every time I try that, like, it fails.
Not even a chrono, eh?
So I think I do have a chronograph in here. But it's a dive chronograph and I'm just going all divers. I mean, that's what I wear all the time.
Yeah.
And if I'm not wearing a diver, I wish I was wearing a diver. So I think my strategy here was to go, if you have three watches with 10 grand to spend, I wanted to do something where I've got something modern that I wear most of the time that I'm really happy with. That's kind of my, I don't want to say halo piece, but you know, the one that is the most special. And then something vintage because I do like wearing vintage every now and then. I don't wear it very often because of the lack of lume and rarity, water resistance, etc. But I do like a vintage piece, especially an old diver. And then mm-hmm. like a third one that would be typically something affordable, but definitely something rugged, something that, you know, I'm not going to use the word beater, but, you know, a lot of people would use that term. So, you know, to kind of come up with that threesome, what I end up with are variations of what I have. And then you could kind of substitute in different pieces from my existing collection that are sort of iterations of the same theme. So I'll start with kind of my first scenario, and that is, big surprise, my most of my 10 grand will go towards the Seamaster Pro. Mm-hmm. Having worn mine, the white dial one, since, gosh, what was it, September, on the rubber strap for the most part. This is a $5,100 retail watch. Now, assuming you could get some of these, if not all, any of these that we're going to suggest, either pre-owned or with some level of discount, you know, you can play with it as you will, but it retails for $5,100 on the rubber strap. You know, having worn this since last fall, almost nonstop, it's got to be in my collection. I mean, it's a fantastic watch. I think I've teased out enough time. The honeymoon's over and I'm still wearing it. So I think that's a really solid choice. It's a great, could be an only watch. I wear it, you know, you can wear it every day. You can do pretty much anything in it. Good water resistance, right. Anti-magnetic, etc. And then I got to go with for the vintage option, I'm going with a sub 300T Doxa. Now I've got, if I were to look at my current collection, I do have one vintage Doxa. I've got a T-Graph, the black dial T-Graph. So I kind of tick that box with my collection, but that's worth a little more nowadays. So I can't fit that into a $10,000 budget. But in this scenario, I'm going to go with like a sub 300T, which you can still get for, gosh, I've seen them as low as $2,500 still, but you know, let's say $3,500 for a good example.
Yeah.
I'd probably go for probably a Shark Hunter or a Sea Rambler, depending on kind of the condition. I'm not a huge orange dial professional fan, so I'd probably go with a Sharky or a Sea Rambler. So that gets me, you know, up tickling 9,000. And then that leaves me, you know, a grand or a little over. So then I'm going to go with my beloved, you know, CWC. That's going to be my kind of affordable rugged piece that if I go with the quartz option, which retails from CWC new for $675, leaves me a lot of money left over that I can just, you know, buy a ton of NATO straps because that's all it takes. And that's the watch that I would kind of just pack away as a backup on a trip or kind of just wear it for more rough duty. Although I love the watch, so I'd wear it a lot as well. But if I wanted to kind of get right up against the $10,000 budget, I'd maybe swap out that CWC for something like the SPB 143 Seiko that you have, which retails for $1,200. And I think that would put me right at about 10 grand. And I think that would be a really solid, really solid trio. I'd get, you know, my vintage diver, I'd get kind of that higher end Omega, and then you know, something from Japan, a good solid handsome rugged Seiko, or that quartz CWC, and that would get me right up next to $10,000. So that's
absolutely,
that's kind of my first go at it. What do you think of those?
I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, obviously the Seamaster Pro has kind of like really won you over recently. So I think it's a nice update because that's not a watch you would have picked on episode 33.
Yeah, definitely. Right.
We weren't talking about that watch. It was out in a few versions. Now you can get a ton. I'm curious, if you were to rebuy that watch today, mm-hmm. in a vacuum, would you go with the white one again or something, the new green one?
I think I'd still go white. I think it's still the best looking one. I don't know if, you know, the other one's actually appeal to me less. I think the green one's cool, but I think I'd tire of it. Black one's a little too
shiny,
predictable,
maybe?
Shiny. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And then blue one is too blue.
It's a lot of blue. I agree. So, and you remember back in the day when they were doing the 1120 based ones, they had a blue electric dial.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
With, the sword hands, but it had a steel bezel.
Yes.
Like a relief bezel.
Yeah.
That kind of balances it.
Yeah.
The new ones are a lot of blue, especially if you compare them to, you know, like the mid-90s Bond,
mm-hmm.
the original Bond, Seamaster.
Very flat,
which
blue.
It wasn't as bright, and it wasn't quite as vivid. Vivid's probably a better word.
Yeah.
So I feel you on that one. I love the white for sure. And then a Doxa sub.
Yeah.
New, old,
I mean, I think vintage Doxas.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think you need one for one thing. I just think everybody that's into dive watches needs like a vintage Doxa. I think it is they are the coolest vintage dive watches. I think, you know, you can get a vintage Rolex or vintage Seamaster, whatever, but
so much money now.
Once you handle like a vintage Doxa, I think, mm-hmm. you know, when I came to Vancouver that time, I brought my silver dial T-Graph, which I don't have anymore, but you know, you felt that watch. It feels as solid and as heavy and as like awesome as a new one, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yep. And its appeal is different than a new one.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Much. They're distinct in that they're old.
Right, right.
So look, I've got several options here. I made three different options. You can tell it's tough to decide. Fun thing is if I was going to reset today and I couldn't have the Explorer 2, I think I'd finally fulfill that role and get into Tudor. Because there'd be no reason to be patient on something that may not exist anymore. So the first kind of trio that I thought up would be the Pelagos Blue, mm-hmm. which I've really been eyeing lately. Especially as I start to wear a few watches that are like 41, 42 millimeters, and I go like, why do I think that the Pelagos is too big?
Yeah,
'cause it's not.
Yeah, yeah.
So that may happen on its own anyways. It would be the Tudor Pelagos Blue, which is 4750. You know, I love the bracelet. I love the strap. Amazing bezel, great lume. It's all, you know, we talk about this watch basically every episode. And then obviously me being me, I need a GMT.
Yeah.
You know, my options under that would suit a $10,000 budget that still needs three watches don't mm-hmm. really leave you that many. Mm-hmm. There's an obvious one, but I think it, you know, the Black Bay GMT and a Pelagos is a little bit much.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would probably go with a Zin 144 ST GMT, which I owned years ago. They're worth about three times as much now. So you're looking at around $3,000 for a tidy 144, maybe even a little bit more.
Wow. Yeah.
But that watch would check all the boxes for a watch that isn't a dive watch in my world. So a multifunction tool watch, nicely made, not too big, great on a bunch of straps, really fun on a bracelet, chronograph and GMT. And sure, it's not a flyer GMT, it's a collar, but it is a collar that I found quite useful because mm-hmm. it's a 12-hour setup.
Oh, right.
So you can still kind of jump that hand around or you can hide it versus a 24-hour hand where when you're jumping it, it's kind of a different zone.
Yeah.
So that would be my option for the second one. So now we've got a nice titanium dive watch, a solid German chronograph, GMT, do it all. And then to finish, this one's a little bit nebulous because, you know, it's kind of a changing world, but I would probably just try and find a tidy, fun gold or gold plated vintage watch.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I could do something like my chronograph Swiss for whatever I have left, 2250, super. If I could do something like my Minstop with the bracelet, the Buren, super. I would just want something that could kind of check the box for nerdy, dressy, and fun gold all in one.
Yeah.
Because there are scenarios in which the Zin and the Tudor, there are scenarios in which I dress where the Zin and the Tudor would be fine, but wouldn't really have a style that I want, if that makes sense. And the gold would absolutely hit it. So something like the Buren, something like the Chronograph Swiss, like that would check my vintage box and the gold, which is kind of my favorite zone these days as for vintage watches.
Yeah.
And I think that would be my first trio. And that, like I said, depending on what I spent on the vintage watch, I'd be somewhere between, you know, $88.50 and $10,000.
Yeah, I like those choices. I mean, let's face it, you know, your choices aren't going to work for me and probably vice versa. I think we come close in our tastes, but I think your three very much suit you and your tastes. Like for me, I'm not into gold. I'm not into kind of a dressier watch. But I think those are perfect. And it's funny because it's almost like watches that I feel like you already own or own some version of, even though you don't have Pelagos. You know, we've talked about it enough. It's almost like an unofficial James Stacey watch for whatever
reason. Yeah, I should probably make that happen at some point.
Yeah. My
I'd
issue
have to
with,
pick between that and the carbon.
My issue with the GMT, you know, I've realized I used to think I wanted a GMT, but until that Pelagos GMT comes around, my issue with the GMT is odds are when I'm traveling, there's some water involved in some way.
Yeah.
And then I always think, like, I do own a GMT, actually. I own a Grand Seiko GMT, which has fantastic functionality. It's a beautiful watch. I never wear it, ever. Bought it in Japan. I kind of keep it for sentimental reasons. But, like that's like a business traveler's watch, you know? And I'm not a business traveler. I'm kind of a vacation, holiday, adventure traveler. And that usually involves getting wet and dirty and whatever else. So my GMT would have to be something like a dive GMT. And I haven't quite found the perfect one yet.
You know, the thing is, and I can say this and nothing more. There is something coming out later that would check some of these boxes at a price point people aren't necessarily ready for. I can't say anything more than that. But, you know, it's not watch this space. It's certainly not our announcement. But there's the options will continue to grow, I think, for GMTs. and those that, that can, you know, do double duty on a vacation. You know, the other one you could do if you really maxed out your other two budgets, and it would be one that I would absolutely consider. I still talk about it a fair bit, is that Seiko Kinetic SUN023.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah.
So that's a big watch, but you wear it while diving. Who cares? Mm-hmm. Like, it's a vacation watch. Who cares if it's, I think it's 46 or 47.
Yeah.
Never felt big in my life. Nice rubber strap, black case, mega loom, local jumping, quartz, all the stuff. It did everything. I took it diving in Hawaii a few times back 17 or 16.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, it was awesome. Might even in 2015. Great watch. And I think they're worth maybe $500 or $600. I think maybe list is like $750.
Yeah.
So that way you could really do a, my problem is like, I don't want to buy a dive GMT and also have the Pelagos, cause I'm just going to want to take the Pelagos. This is one of those scenarios where we need that. For those of you who listen to the Q&A, there's a fantastic question about kind of dream modules for watch straps, like those compasses, like the, Breitling UTC things.
Yeah.
And I had suggested, you know, a sort of cool titanium clip-on or integrated link sort of solution that was just a little digital screen that could show you another time zone and keep up with a dive watch. So maybe that on a Pelagos would kind of do it, or I mean the Pelagos that I mean, talk about a broken record. GMT Pelagos of some sort.
Well, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking of kind of flipping around my trio, my scenario, and rather than go with the brand new Seamaster Pro, if I still kind of want that same vibe, you have to remember those Seamaster Professionals, kind of the previous generation, actually maybe a couple generations ago, like the Bond era, like late 90s, maybe early 2000s, they actually made a GMT Seamaster Pro diver. Do you remember that? It had like a little red hand.
They made the blue wave dial one. Yeah. So that was with the 1120 base. That was the same, the watches that would eventually become the Great White.
Yeah.
The 2534 and the black version of the same watch. Both watches that were on my list for this challenge, because you can snap those up. I actually don't know what the one with the little red arrow hand would cost, or the reference. My apologies.
Yeah.
But the Great White and the black version of that same watch, like, they're still around for about $3,000, $3,500.
Yeah.
With a bracelet, probably with most of the box of papers, all that kind of, like, that's a pretty compelling combination of dive and travel watch. I mean, those have a 24-hour bezel, which is a bit of a bummer, right?
Right, but if you go with the dive version with the little red hand, right. I mean, that's just got the 24-hour scale on the dial, and I believe that's cool. Local jumping.
I need to figure. I'll find that reference for the show notes.
Because then I could really flip things around. Then you could go like, okay, now I'm ad-libbing here. I'm going off script.
Yeah, please.
But you know, you could, and again, I don't know the exact prices of these, but let's say you can get one of these Seamaster Pro early 2000s with the little red hand, the GMT version. You know, if you got one of those used, which that's the only way you can get it nowadays, for let's say $3,000, then you've got a little more money to play with. Then you could go new Doxa or something higher end for a newer watch, and then you kind of hit all the scenarios. I've got my travel GMT with sort of the vintagey flavor to it, you know, sort of like an older style, kind of cool watch, get a little faded out. That could be kind of fun.
Yeah, so this is it turns out I was wrong. This watch actually came out later than the GMTs I listed because it's a coaxial movement.
Oh, it is. Oh,
man, okay. This is a compelling watch. Hold on.
All right.
So it's a mid-era Bond, so not the early 90s one, but not the ceramic dial one.
Yeah.
It's kind of in that zone between. The reference is a 2535.80, so 80 is the bracelet. That's your Bond bracelet. So it's a 2535 S&P 300M GMT.
Oh, yeah.
Let's see if I can find what one of those might go for. I don't know, man. This is cool.
Oh, that is cool.
Thing. Now, I do wonder what if it's a flyer or a collar.
I think it's a flyer.
Yeah, I believe it would be a flyer if it's using the coaxial movement, because it'd be the same that's on conceivably the PO GMT, which is a...
Yeah.
Yeah. Anywhere from, you know, I'm looking at Chrono 24, so good luck. If there's one in your area, I think you can do pretty well here. But I'm seeing everything from $3,400 up.
Yeah.
So a lot of watch for that money. Good looking, super blue, really blue.
Yeah.
With the bezel. But then you've got the GMT. Yeah, that's compelling. Good pull. Yeah. Really good pull.
Yeah.
Did not hit my radar.
Yeah. What else? You've got another scenario here that looks also compelling, if not even more compelling in my eyes.
Yeah, two or three. too?
I like parts of both of your second series.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I'll blend them. So look, we've got maybe 10 minutes left before I have to jump in an Uber to get to the airport. So
yeah.
I'm going to buzz through a few of the other ones. So my option two was a Tudor Black Bay GMT, a watch I still adore. Fantastic functionality. Really, in my mind, still the go-to GMT watch for anyone, because I just don't know how you get a GMT Master these days, or if, like, I don't know that I would want a GMT Master over a Black Bay GMT, just for taste.
Yeah.
If we get into a 16710, then you're in a different zone because of my love of five-digit Rolexes. But the six-digit ones, I see them a lot. I think I'd rather the Black Bay GMT. And so that's 4860. And then in this zone, I thought, well, I still need a real true dive watch. So that'd be the Doxa Carbon White Pearl 3990.
So cool. Oh, yeah.
Which is super fun. Imagine those are two watches that could, like, kind of exist in the same space, but couldn't be more different.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, with whatever's left there, which is actually not an insignificant amount of money, I figure you got to balance this out in my zone with something of a dress watch. Something with a gold case. So this is that weird little Seiko 33.5mm quartz with the high accuracy quartz, the Dolce SACM 150.
Yeah.
And I just said, like, and then let me spend like another $400 or $500 on straps.
Yeah.
Because it's got drilled lugs. It just begs for different straps. This is a watch you wear and don't even notice. It's really handsome, super easy to wear, right?
Yeah.
And a watch that I'm still really very much enjoying and just trying to figure out the most fun way to write a story about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the option three, which is kind of a fun one. And I think there's, you know, there's zones where you could kind of take one from all of these options, but it would be the Carbon White Pearl, a Breitling Aerospace, probably the early, I couldn't get a full gold one for this money. I think it would cost me like 11 grand is what I've seen those go for the full gold Aerospace, which is super fun.
Yeah.
Hilarious, but super fun. Well, it's because they're on a full gold bracelet. At that point, the weight of the metal comes into play.
Yeah.
But an Aerospace, I think you could still get a 56062 or maybe even one a little bit later than that. Still 40mm, still really thin. No backlight. You've got to go to the newer ones or even up to an Evo to get the backlight. But I could deal without. And that would be a travel watch, a sports watch, a running watch, my chronograph, all that kind of stuff. And they're like, I think $1,500 is a fair thing to say for those. But they're kind of all over the map.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be a question of finding one. And then if you got lucky and there wasn't competition, you could make an offer and that kind of thing. And then I've got a ton of money left here if I do the White Pearl and the Aerospace, the better part of $5,000. I think I would hunt down an interesting Cartier tank, something quartz, maybe a Vermeil, a Must, a Cartier, something with a cool dial that I could put a ton of different straps on. I think you'd have to hunt to get one for $5,000. Like, you could get something really small for probably two or three, maybe even less.
Yeah.
Sometimes I see them for less. But to get one kind of in the mid-size range and that kind of worked, I think then imagine, you know, the White Pearl, the Aerospace, and a Cartier tank is kind of, you're playing three games at once. That's not, none of those are happening on the same field.
Well, that's crazy that Cartier then would actually be the most spendy of the trio for your $10,000.
But I think you could make it that way.
Probably the one that you'd wear the least. That's an interesting kind of flip of the equation there.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is, like, I think if I was starting all over again, the first call I'd make would be for a Pelagos.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I would probably, you know, hope to just come across a good GMT that's of interest to me. Mm-hmm. And then I would spend the rest on, like, just quietly, like, I'd be watching whatever retro watch guys got for gold, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And just kind of snapping that kind of stuff up. But I think that's kind of where my mind is today on three watch stuff. I think if you're in a scenario where, yeah, you had to reset your collection or that sort of thing, I don't know that you can. I don't think I could do a three watch collection today and not end up with a Tudor.
Yeah.
Is the easy thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's such an interesting exercise. And for some reason, like I said, it's appealing. The idea is very appealing. It's almost like we should have like a big fire sale and just purge our collections and whittle it down. But I don't know. You know, what happens is, you know, the rest of my collection now actually become sort of, like I said, these iterations of the same theme. So I could substitute my Tornik Rayville for the CWC or this old Benthos I've got for the T-Graph or like a Bremont for the Seamaster, you know. So I think what we're talking about here aren't very specific watches necessarily. It's taking that budget and like finding watches of a specific genre or type.
And I mean, the truth is like, let's say if this number was $5,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would have just said, get me an S302 and a dressy Seiko.
Yeah.
Because I still wear that Braymon a ton. It does dive and GMT really well. It's just the right size.
Yeah.
So any one of these ones in the $3,000 to $5,000 range for my picks could easily become a Braymon. That's kind of the pinch hitter in that scenario.
Yeah.
Whether it was maybe too difficult to find something else or whatnot. I hold that Braymon right up there with the Pelagos in my mind.
Yeah.
A very focused, easy to wear. I think really handsome looking kind of dive GMT dive GMT, yeah, which is my preference.
Yeah. Cool.
Well, you want to jump into some final notes so we can maybe not miss my flight?
Yeah, definitely. I'll go first. My jet lag time was spent binging a bunch of shows. I mentioned this last time we had a proper episode. And one of the series that we watched was Slow Horses. And this is a very high recommendation for me. I read the book. I think I had talked about even the book a while back by Mick Herron. He's written a whole series of the kind of the Slough House series of books. These are very kind of clever, witty, very different takes on kind of the spy novel genre. And this, the series on Apple TV based on the first book is just fantastic. And, you know, starting off, I was skeptical, you know, as I always am when a movie or a show is made out of a book, but it's perfect in terms of location and casting, and I think just kind of the general tone. And then of course Gary Oldman is
oh my goodness,
I mean, he's always excellent, good no matter what he does, but like having seen him in Tinker Tailor playing George Smiley and then here playing Jackson Lamb in Slow Horses, mm-hmm, like it's couldn't be a more different character, but he nails that as well. And then there's this guy who plays River Cartwright, kind of the maybe you call him the main protagonist of the story. He's played by Jack Loudon, who I think I've seen before, but I can't place him. But he does a really nice job of it.
Yeah,
he's good. So
I you know, I just finished this as well. I absolutely adored it. It's such a razor sharp take on like modern, like even the bureaucracy or the internal politics of being part of a modern spy outfit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And there's these different levels and there's a lot of like prestige and looking down at one's nose at people who've made mistakes. And
yeah.
And then you have Lamb, who you don't really understand. He seems like an oaf, a louse, you know, just kind of a trash dude. Right.
Yeah.
And it turns out that's not accurate. It's just that he's at a point in his life where he doesn't really care about first impressions.
Right.
And it turns out he plays this kind of interesting role. I think the casting is incredible. I really like Jack Loudon. It took me a little while to realize what was hitting for me with his performance, and it's because it really feels like Simon Pegg.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who I'm a huge fan of.
Yeah.
He kind of looks like he could be a Simon Pegg's brother or a cousin or something like that, especially with the hair the way he is. If you see his picture on Google Image Search or whatever, you're kind of like, no, this guy's a bit of a shapeshifter, but the way he looks in this definitely hit. And I love the specificity. You know, the building where they shot Slough House is the actual building that Mick Herron would walk by when he was writing the books. And the fun thing is this isn't one of those ones where you watch the first season and then you're going to have to wait 2 years for the next one. The second season's already shot.
Yeah, I noticed that.
And it should come out. I don't believe there's a release date, but we shouldn't have to wait super long for it.
Yeah.
But I co-sign what Jason said. This is a must watch. Not one for kids. Some really fantastic bad language.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, super watchable, slow and patient, with all sorts of good payoff.
Yeah.
And great writing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Fantastic stuff.
What do you have?
My pick for this week is actually also a show that I've enjoyed because I would have talked about Slow Horses either at the top or as my pick. I'm now about five episodes into Tokyo Vice, which a couple folks sent us emails about because Michael Mann is involved with it. So I got a lot of DMs when this was announced, like, oh, it's Ansel Elgort, who was the lead in Baby Driver, doing a show based on this book called Tokyo Vice. The show's being kind of run and set up by J.T. Rogers, whose name you might know. He has quite a history in stage plays and other stuff like that. And then Michael Mann is one of the EPs. It's this like super patient, deeply character-driven look at a young American man who decides to move to Tokyo to try and become a crime reporter at a newspaper that's never hired a foreigner.
Huh.
And in the process, he's kind of likable, but also is an outsider. And so people on both sides of the law, cops and the Yakuza, kind of attach to him as friends. and it becomes this kind of complicated noir with a love triangle and some other stuff. And I'm really enjoying it. It's not a run and gun. There's some violence for sure, but it's not a cowboy, you know, it's not a Heat. It's not something like that. It's a little bit more patient, a little bit more deliberate. And if you're either a fan of kind of crime novellas like this, or if you just love Tokyo as a setting,
yeah,
I think they do both of those elements really well. And as good as Ansel Elgort can be or is, I think he's okay in this. But it has Ken Watanabe, who's just like one of the best. And then there's a handful of people who are kind of new to me, including Rinko Kikuchi and Sho Kasamatsu.
Huh.
My apology for the pronunciation, but their performances are... I can't really look away. Not only are you kind of drawn in by the subtitles, but also these performances and the writing is really strong. I highly recommend Tokyo Vice. I think you're better to start with Slow Horses if you just want something to hit.
Yeah.
The first couple episodes of Slow Horses are really slow, like almost intentionally.
Yeah, yeah.
They kind of highlight the boredom of these people's jobs and what their existence is now. But both of these absolutely recommend both winners.
Yeah, a couple good picks. Where's Tokyo Vice playing?
HBO.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, so definitely worth it. And then Slow Horses, like you said, is Apple TV.
Yeah.
So those are your options. I think these days everybody can get everything.
Yeah.
Well, not everywhere in the world, but most places. So
yeah.
I would say either one of these is worth the subscription for the month, and then you can decide if there's other stuff you like on there.
Cool. Well, that was a fun episode. And I don't think you're hopefully you're not in jeopardy.
No, my Uber should be here in 4 minutes.
Oh, there we go.
So I'll save the file and I'll download your side of the chat when I get to the airport and hopefully make it through customs.
Awesome.
As always, you know, thanks so much for listening, for everything that you guys do for the show and supporting Jason and I, be it directly through the supporter system or just sending emails and doing the Instagram stuff and listening to the show and sharing it with your friends. We appreciate all of that. If you'd like to subscribe to the show notes, get into the comments for each episode, and maybe even consider supporting the show directly, which can get you, you know, a TGN signed NATO and a sticker and that kind of stuff, please just visit thegraynato.com. And music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from E.F. Schumacher, who said, "Any intelligent fool can make things bigger, more complex, and more violent. It takes a touch of genius and a lot of courage to move in the opposite direction."